were Don still with us, you know, he'd say, well, you know, it's really easy to go plant something. But the question is that thing ready? And is the system in place? Mm-hmm. And is the market there?
Welcome to the 367th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. A little over a decade ago, I interviewed a University of Minnesota plant scientist named Don Wise about Forever Green, an initiative that had just been launched a few years before. Forever Green was the brainchild of Wise and others in the academic and sustainable ag community, and over the years, it's worked to develop a portfolio of crops that are more sustainable than the traditional corn-soybean rotation that dominates the Midwest today. The ultimate goal is to have living plants present on the land throughout the year, which would not only build soil health and prevent erosion, but protect water quality by reducing the need for chemical inputs. Today, some 16 crops, from hazelnuts to pennycress, are under development via the Forever Green Initiative. The Land Stewardship Project and several of our allies were backers of Forever Green from the beginning, and we have worked successfully to get the Minnesota legislature to provide funding for the initiative. It's hard to overstate how important it is that lawmakers have been willing to provide public funds to support agricultural research that's not tied to the traditional corn-soybean commodity system. It's exciting to see how far an initiative that dares to diversify the agricultural landscape has come in just over a dozen years. But as Don repeatedly made clear whenever he had a chance, no matter how many breeding breakthroughs are made and alternative cropping systems developed, it does little good if they don't make practical and financial sense for farmers. If you want to change the landscape, give farmers an economic opportunity to change the landscape, he once told me. That's why Forever Green not only focuses on the science behind developing innovative crops and cropping systems, it also works on the commercialization, adoption, and scaling of continuous living cover crops in the region. If you know anything about Forever Green, it's probably because of Kernza. Kernza is a form of intermediate wheatgrass, a distant cousin of wheat, that was introduced to this country over a century ago as a forage crop. Over the years, groups like the Land Institute have been working with Forever Green to develop a line of Kernza that can produce both forage and grain in the upper Midwest without being replanted year after year. Farmers in the region have found that thus far, they can grow it for roughly 3 years without replanting it, making it the world's first commercially viable perennial grain. When Dr. Don Wise tragically died after suffering a fall in July 2024, we lost not only an innovative plant breeder, but someone who was a standard bearer for what the land grant mission is all about. That's using science to serve the land, communities, and most importantly, people. And that meant not just developing a new cropping system because it made sense scientifically or agronomically, but making sure it made sense for the farmers who were taking the risk of growing it. I've been thinking a lot about that last point lately. Ear to the Ground episodes 365 and 366 feature farmers who are growing Kernza on an experimental basis. As those interviews make clear, these farmers are very excited about the potential a perennial grain has for building soil health, diversifying agriculture, and protecting the environment. But, like many farmers I've talked to who are growing Kernza, finding consistent markets has been a challenge. Still, these farmers remain committed to giving this and other cutting-edge crops a chance. They feel the potential long-term payoff is worth the risk. After all, for many decades, soybeans were grown in this country as a forage before they became the commodity juggernaut they are today. In a sense, the lessons we've learned about the challenges and opportunities related to developing and marketing Kernza and making it an economically viable part of the food system could be applied to a lot of crops, both the new varieties that are being researched by Forever Green, as well as the more traditional grains and oilseeds that have been crowded out over the years by corn and soybeans. That's why I was glad to have the opportunity recently to talk to Colin Curitan and Catherine Choot. Colin is the Director of Commercialization, Adoption, and Scaling at Forever Green. Catherine is a product and market specialist for the initiative. I was glad to hear that Forever Green had people like Colin and Catherine on board. It shows a commitment to the principles Don Wise felt needed to be foundational to the initiative. Given my recent conversations with farmers who were having a hard time selling their Kernza, it was particularly good to touch base with two people who think a lot about marketing and product development. In October, I went to the U of M's Borlaug Hall on the St. Paul campus to talk to Colin and Catherine about the challenges farmers and processors face when working with a new crop like Kernza, and the ways folks like them are working to take some of the risk out of pushing the envelope agronomically and economically. Colin started our discussion by providing a summary of the Forever Green initiative itself.
Forever Green is an agricultural innovation platform that is rather unique in the country, if not the world. It's based here at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics, but extends into multiple other departments and outside the walls of this university. And as a platform, we focus on developing new perennial and winter annual crops and cropping systems, really as new tools for farmers and industry and society to address this major challenge we have of a highly agriculturally productive system, but that's productive for part of the year. We have crops and living cover and roots in the soil on the land for 3 to 4 months a year, which leaves us without living cover or roots in the soil for 8 months a year. And that has a lot of consequences for water quality, soil health, climate, rural livelihoods, rural economies, etc. And so our theory of change is that developing in a comprehensive way these new tools for farmers that keep the soil covered year-round with a market pull, all crops that can be harvested and marketed for everything we derive from the food system, food and agricultural system, food, feed, fuel, fiber, industrial products. To be a little more specific, our portfolio includes about 15 crops at this time that break down into perennial grains and oilseeds, like Kernza perennial grain. We are also developing perennial wheat, which is different than Kernza, perennial flax, perennial sunflower, new perennial oil seeds like Silphium or Silflower. We have a suite of winter annuals. We also call those cash cover crops. They're planted in the fall, harvested in the spring. Things you might have heard about like winter camelina and pennycress, also winter barley, working to advance adoption of hybrid winter rye. And then we also have a subset of woody perennials or agroforestry systems like hybrid hazelnuts, some work on developing the market for things like elderberry. So we have multidisciplinary teams developing these crops and cropping systems. And Catherine and I work on our commercialization, adoption, and scaling team, which focuses on supporting and de-risking farmer adoption, and then also developing, in partnership with many people, value chains and markets for these crops. There's also a wing of Forever Green's work called the Forever Green Partnership that really focuses on community collaboration, policy advocacy at the state and now beyond levels. LSP is a part of that work. And that's been very important for solidifying and growing support from the state of Minnesota.
I'm glad to hear that you folks are on staff doing what you're doing, because I remember talking to Dr. Don Wise when this was getting started, and one of the things that maybe set it apart from other initiatives to research alternative crops or third crops or whatever you want to call it was this focus on kind of the chicken and egg situation, where it doesn't do us any good to develop the best crop in the world if we don't have a market for it, and trying to bring those along at the same time a little bit. So I think that it's really good to see that that is still a focus and it's being supported through staff and people actually being hired to do that kind of thing. So we're going to shift a little bit and focus on Kernza kind of as almost a case study on this idea of developing a crop, a third crop or an alternative crop or whatever you want to call it, and the idea that we've got to develop these profitable markets for it. And I was wondering if you could give us a general sense of, with Kernza, which is probably the thing that people are most familiar with out there right now because it has gotten some publicity, where are we at with the market for Kernza and what's it being used for, what can it be used for, that kind of thing. Yeah, where are we at with that?
Well, my top headline on this topic would be that we've developed some very promising end uses and a lot of products that incorporate Kernza that you can find in Minnesota, that you can find nationally distributed, but that we still need more demand. And so we're actively recruiting businesses of all types that would like to give Kernza a go and learn from the first folks that have given it a try. But to dive into a little bit more detail, I can start through the value chain. So at the beginning, we have the seed producers. So we actually have three companies that are licensed to sell Kernza seed in Minnesota. There's, of course, more activity in other parts of the country, but we'll focus on Minnesota right now. So we have Albert Lee Seed, Minnesota Native Landscapes, and Arcola Farms, who can sell seed here in Minnesota. And then there are currently across the country five different distributors or suppliers of Kernza in a whole grain, flour, or flaked format. And four of those five distributors are here in the state of Minnesota. And then products are spanning across a huge range of different products. We've got successful uses in pasta, naan, pizza crust, crackers, pancake mix, beer, whiskey, sourdough bread. There are people who have figured out how to do a great product with all of those different types of food and beverage. So really exciting to see that success. And when you're out in the marketplace as a consumer, I encourage people to look around for products you can find. So at a nationally distributed level, there is a cereal from General Mills that's in Whole Foods, Kroger, and Giant. There's a number of beers at on tap at breweries across the country in partnership with Patagonia Provisions, the company that's associated with Patagonia, the clothing company. Mm-hmm. And then there also is a line of pasta that Patagonia Provisions has released, and a canned beer through a partnership with Deschutes Brewery. And then also keep an eye out for Kodiak Cakes, which has a pancake mix, and then many, many local companies that are producing products in Minnesota and in other states across the country.
And I think I want to be clear that there have been struggles this whole time. What Catherine mentioned is all true and very exciting. And at the same time, there have been a lot of challenges with Kernza that I think we can get into and learn a lot from. But really, over the last 5 years, what really excites me and makes me proud about the work we've done together in partnership with farmers and rural communities in the state of Minnesota is that everything she mentioned basically didn't exist 5 years ago. There was no reliable seed supply. We now provide Kernza seed to the world. And now 80% or 4 out of 5 of the Kernza distributors in the world are located here in Minnesota. So we're really a national and global leader in the early phase of bringing these products to market. And then seeing the innovation and ingenuity of companies of all sizes, you know, from the General Mills of the world to, you know, businesses that were started classically like in someone's garage or in a warehouse, building equipment by hand, really trying to figure out perennial grains.
You mentioned the farmers, and it's one thing we should touch on maybe early on is, do you have a rough idea how many farmers are raising Kernza and how many acres we're talking about?
On the acreage side, I believe we were at the end of last harvest season at around 2,400 acres, and now there's been some acres that have been planted and some that have rotated out at the end of their 3-year grain production life cycle. So we are waiting on the numbers for this year, which will come out from the Land Institute probably around January or February.
That's not just Minnesota that we're talking about.
Correct. That is across the country. And Colin, do you know the Minnesota number?
Yeah, I have a rough sense that I would say about a third at various points in the last 5 years, up to about a half of national Kernza production has been in the state of Minnesota. Some other centers of production include good partners in Kansas and producers in Montana. There's now Kernza growing, I think, in a dozen or more states. Wisconsin has been a huge partner early on, and they're starting to scale their production as well. But big picture, I would say there's about, 60 farmers collaborating on either, you know, having somewhere between 10 and 100 or more acres each. And in the grand scheme of things, 2,500 acres is like part of one family's farm in North Dakota. But it's actually, you know, four or five dozen producers, early adopters working together to build this market.
This was all from 2023. So we're waiting on this is the time of year we do the surveys, or the Land Institute leads this process, but is collecting actively right now, actually, out meeting with farmers to understand the numbers for 2024.
So we talked about a little bit of the challenges, and I wanted to get into that. And one of the questions I had was, what are some challenges specific to Kernza? Because it is it's always billed as the first commercially viable perennial grain. And that's great. That's all good stuff. But then there are challenges. I've heard things like I've talked to farmers and other folks, size of the seed. But what are some specific challenges with, I guess, marketing and processing and getting it through that system so it's going to end up on people's dinner tables kind of thing?
One is just really about the R&D, mm-hmm. and that we've made great progress to bring what I'd call a minimum viable product to market, an MVP. But think about it. I often use the analogy of an early stage solar panel. Really exciting idea. But how scalable was that solar panel in 1980?
Right?
It needed a lot of R&D improvement. And the good news is that we're doing that work, and we continue to expand that work. But at that stage in the analogy, you know, it was quite expensive. did your utility play ball with it? Did anybody know what it was? Could, you know, like, was there a value chain and a system built around it? Was there supportive policy? Mm-hmm. Were we able to scale? So we're in a very similar place with perennial grains. I think, to be specific, Kernza was developed intentionally as a dual-use crop. Intermediate wheatgrass is actually a forage crop that was brought to the U.S. about 100 years ago. Puts up a lot of biomass, and we really have been promoting Kernza from the outset as a dual-use crop. It hasn't always moved to market that way. So if you want to derive all, as a producer, all of your value from the grain, at this stage, there's not a lot of grain there in the grand scheme of things yet, right? So relative to annual small grains, mm-hmm. you know, we're talking it's yielding at this stage about a quarter. Mm. So think about the economics. Now, if you could lay down half your revenue through forage uses, hay cuttings, and straw baling post-grain harvest, that could significantly boost the revenue opportunity. But then there's a lot of aspects of the R&D that are just put this crop at an early stage. And that's where I wanted to start the conversation, because I think if we just look at the marketing end, we could say this product's too expensive, or there's not enough of it, or it's hard to develop a market around, and all of that is true. And at the same time, so much of the future of perennial grains comes back to continuing to invest in developing a tool that can work for farmers. And that's what Forever Grain's all about, the long game strategy of making Kernza more affordable, more widely adopted, more widely consumed without undermining the value to the farmer, is by improving the crop. And that's where I want to start the conversation. And that's what Forever Green's all about.
I'd like to reiterate the point Colin just made, that it is a long-term vision here. And so I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind. And so we, even as we share a lot of the challenges, these are things that we're working on and many partners are working on every day to try to solve. So Colin mentioned a couple of the things that relate to the cost drivers behind Kernza production. So the yield per acre and the seed size, which is smaller, which also contributes, of course, to the pounds or bushels that you can remove off of an acre. And then on the processing side, because the seed size is smaller and because Kernza currently has a hull, it does take different equipment settings in harvesting using a combine, as well as in the processing stage for cleaning, dehulling, milling, cracking grain for brewing. All of those systems are developed with equipment that's used to much larger grain sizes. And so there's currently a learning curve where people are trying to understand how to use the existing equipment we have, and also where we might need to develop new equipment. So all of those things contribute to a less efficient processing infrastructure. And over time, we believe that's going to change and to come down in cost, just like other technologies have. Then on the marketing side, I think some of the challenges that we face include a lack of general consumer awareness. Mm-hmm. And programs like the Patagonia Provisions Partnership, like all of the small businesses here in Minnesota who are featuring Kernza products and promoting them throughout the state, those are all building awareness. And every time I talk to a new group, I feel like there's a couple more people who know about Kernza. So it's all really positive. But if you were to survey the entire country or the world, what is Kernza? I think the numbers would still be lower than we'd like them to be for this to continue growing. Then also on the marketing side, there's the question of how do you use Kernza? So it is, despite having the name intermediate wheatgrass as the base species for Kernza, it's not wheat. It's distantly related to wheat, but it doesn't function like wheat, and it's not quite rye, and it's not quite rice. I say it has different characteristics that are similar to all three of those things, but there's been a lot of experimentation done by chefs and brewers and distillers and others to try to figure out how to use it functionally. And we're still in the process of communicating that to new users of Kernza.
So one thing I'm struck by, both Catherine, you and Colin are talking about with Kernza, and we're just really at that beginning stages, and this is something I remember talking to the late Dr. Don Wise about. The point he always made was, hey, we assume soybeans have always been around. And that this is a good comparison. I think soybeans were not always, that was a new crop, and we had to import it from Asia, this idea of raising soy, this oil seed, and there had to be a harvesting system set up. There had to be, you know, I was just spent 2 weeks in Iowa helping with the harvest down there, and it's a different corn. You have a corn head and you have a soybean head. You know, it's and people just assume it. Well, that's always the way it's been. But it was a whole different handling, processing, all of that. I think that, to me, that's a good thing to keep in mind, that just because we assume something is the way it is today. It was always that way, and soybeans, other crops had their initial beginning stages as well.
Yeah, definitely. This is something I've thought a lot about. I was actually a history major before I went back and did a bunch of policy and economics and food systems development work. But something when I got hired in my role 6 years ago, one of the first things I asked was to figure out how to do this now. It could be helpful to understand how new crops have come to the landscape before.
Yeah.
And I have kind of just a working kind of sketch or idea of how that happens. I think any major innovation or change in the agricultural system, it's pretty rare that it just happens by choice because it's hard to do. You often see that there's some geopolitical shock that comes along that really makes society stop and say, we got to do something differently. And in that case, with the soybean example, it was World War II. And so our in the United States, supply of oils coming from Southeast Asia was cut off due to blockades and trade issues related to World War II, and there was a concern at the federal level about the domestic protein supply. So there had been people running around in the U.S. for 50 years promoting what they called the magic bean. That was soybean, because soybean is not a new crop in Asia. It's been around for 1,000 years or more, but was brought to the United States to address this geopolitical challenge. And then the federal government started investing in soybean. And actually at that time, the federal government, I'm pretty sure, put in place guaranteed federal contracts for soybean because they needed to develop both the wartime effort and domestic protein supply and start to develop a domestic supply of oils for industrial and other uses. And actually the first soybean crop that came to the U.S. was as a forage crop, was grown years before World War II as a forage crop. Mm-hmm. And I think the first soybean variety, Don Wise would always remind us, that came out of the University of Minnesota, you know how much it yielded? Something like 17 bushel. The point is we've increased several fold the yield of that crop based on billions and billions of dollars of investment, right? And so we're on that similar technology development curve. Development of canola also started around that time of a World War II and really culminated in the 1970s coming out of Canada. And so we have a couple examples, and I just, you know, ask you and your listeners, like, what's the geopolitical shock of our time? It's probably climate. Natural resource pressure, right?
Yeah.
So that often opens a window in what are otherwise, you know, there's concepts of like technological lock-in or path dependency in the food and agriculture system. There's a lot of risk, and the policy supports the market, supports the R&D, supports the policy, supports the market, and that system is pretty locked in, and there's a lot of risk to changing it. And every once in a while, because of that pressure, you know, that comes from that macro level, kind of opens windows for change. And there's always kind of solutions fighting for entry into the system. There's a whole body of work around this called multi-level perspective in academia, but really it's how do systems change, and specifically how does the food and agriculture system change.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a rough sketch of how this has happened before, but I've thought a lot about this because we can't simply do whatever was done for soybean because it's a different time. It's a different issue. It's a different economy. But some similar ideas can take shape in the kinds of solutions we might need. I'm kind of inspired by how this has happened historically.
I would add, I don't know if I'd call this a geopolitical shock to the system, but it is a factor that's played into people being excited about something like Kernza and getting more perennial crops on the landscape. Is here in Minnesota specifically the nitrate issue and water quality, and that's really tied in with Kernza, because I've seen these, I've been to field days where they've dug these soil pits with the Kernza and seen the roots go down several feet, and that's some of the great research that's come out of the U, is showing how much it can soak up that nitrate. So that's another kind of on a smaller scale, something that we're really dealing with, that this may help really spark that interest in a crop like this.
In the areas of Kernza's environmental benefits, where we have the best research is in water quality. And because of this deep, dense root system, if you haven't seen it, listeners, you can Google Kernza perennial grain deep roots, and a picture will come up showing an annual wheat plant, you know, extending down a couple, you know, maybe 2 or 3 feet, and a Kernza root system that's fibrous, wide, dense, and stretches about 10 feet down. So that really acts as a sponge for developing soil health, increasing infiltration, but also soaking up that nitrogen that's there and those nutrients, and very little nitrogen leaves that system to groundwater. The evidence we have that's been replicated several times over is that Kernza reduces nitrate leaching by 95 to 99% compared to corn. Depends what we would call it, or the geopolitical shock or not, but if any of your listeners are familiar with like the donut economics concept, if that's something you've ever heard of, there's this idea that there's kind of 9 planetary boundaries that we need to stay within. And it's a way to tie the space for productive, healthy, safe economic activity, mm-hmm. kind of has to respect social foundations yeah. and stay within planetary boundaries. Hmm. And one of those planetary boundaries is, I think, nutrient loading in our waterways. And everybody thinks about carbon, that like we got this carbon tunnel vision. But the planetary boundary that we're way out beyond, almost more than any other one, is nutrient loading in our water systems. Hmm. So it's really a significant global problem. We talk about the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. That's in major deltas of agricultural regions all over the world. So it's a really big challenge that we've been basically for 75 years adding really significant amounts of synthetic fertilizer, and that's running into our groundwater, our surface waters and our groundwaters. Yeah. And in the state of Minnesota, we know that's a big challenge that, you know, the EPA has recently come in and said, Minnesota, you got to do something about this.
We touched on this, the challenges before, and I want to kind of go back into that a little deeper. This is my opinion, but I feel that it's this hard balance that you try to strike with a new crop like this, in that there was a ton of excitement around it, because I think it showed that the timing was right. It might have been nice if it could have quietly entered the scene, because there was so much excitement. And I was wondering if you could touch on that, the horse is out of that barn, we can't do anything about it, but there was some kind of false starts a little bit.
You know, I don't speak for anyone else, and I'm very hesitant, you know, to do that. And point, I think a lot of partners that have been in the game since early have stayed in the game at some high cost and risk and sometimes headache. But I think if were Don still with us, you know, he'd say, well, you know, it's really easy to go plant something. But the question is that thing ready? And is the system in place? Mm-hmm. And is the market there? Right? And I think excitement about perennial grains ran ahead of their readiness by a bit. And since we've put a lot of things in place, like a reliable seed supply, those distributor partners that Catherine mentioned, some value chain solutions, I think in that those early days, people didn't really fully know how Kernza was going to come to market. And so I think something we've learned is developing more clear and strong go-to-market pathways for these mm-hmm. crops, because you get a first chance once. Doesn't mean you can't keep working. But to your point, I think we've seen a lot of progress, but we're still asking, you know, what happened in 2019? there was a push to plant a fair amount with an early stage, variety candidate. So we hadn't released any crop variety yet. And again, this was all before my time here. So I'm a little hesitant to speak to any particulars. But I do know what the response has been since that. And my kind of role here at the university was in large part created to better support this interface. Just to zoom out generally, there's a big challenge with new technologies that are developed at institutions and then the gulf between how those move into the market. Mm-hmm. So this is this big gap that a lot of things sit on shelves or have underwhelming, you know, entrance into the market. And so especially in agriculture, there's so high costs, high risk, low margins, that this capacity that Catherine and myself and the team tries to bridge that gap. And that's been a really critical way that we've responded to any of the early challenges. I think we have somewhat of a better story now, even though, as I mentioned, there's still, I think, a lot of needs. And what would I say? There's partners that are really excited to be expanding their Kernza operations and others that have had a frustrating experience. And the key thing Don would always tell us to, tell the truth, right? So we're not here to tell you a story. We're here to tell you the truth about where we're at.
So right now, when a farmer harvests their crop of Kernza, what are their options? I'll be honest, I've talked to several farmers this year alone who are still storing previous year's crops and are expressing some frustration with the markets and marketing. If you're a typical farmer who's put in maybe 50 acres of Kernza and you go to harvest it, what are your options? And maybe what do you have any insights into why we're seeing so many farmers having to store their crops? Is that just a personal decision, or is that there isn't that market there for them, or what's going on there? Any ideas on that?
Well, first, I definitely want to empathize with the frustration. It's hard to see anyone storing a crop that they want to sell, and we're hearing that as well. So I can share some updates on what the options are and where things stand. So I think first at a high level, we are seeing that a lot of the regenerative organic certified Kernza as well as organic Kernza is being sold actively and, you know, is finding a market. And where we're seeing a lot more of the stagnation is in a mismatch of supply and demand for the conventionally grown or non-organic Kernza. And we're working on trying to find new market opportunities for that. And I would say in the short term, maybe directed towards anyone who is considering growing Kernza or thinking about what to do with current grain is to continue talking to the five suppliers who are selling Kernza in the market. And some of them are doing a lot of active business development and may come across new opportunities. And so those groups are the Perennial Promise Growers Cooperative, Perennial Pantry, Arcola Farms, Field Theory, and Sustain-A-Grain. I think they are the best contacts to understand where to market grain. And then on the smaller side, I would also mention if you are someone who has capacity to do some direct marketing, business development at local businesses has been quite successful. Granted, it's smaller scale, but looking to breweries, distilleries, local food co-ops, or if you know of millers in your area that might be interested in finding some uses or a business that could experiment with the flour, you know, those are, of course, more difficult to do. But that's where I would start things.
It's funny, it's not that different maybe than anything that's out of the corn soybean norm in that you can't just take it to the local elevator. I mean, even oats, farmers are having problems with oats, which was a traditional crop here in the upper Midwest. Really anything that's a little bit different than the corn soybean system is just not as, there isn't the handling, storage facilities, the handling facilities, transportation facilities. It's all kind of, you know, farmers are storing their Kernza in totes, you know, and I was at a farm a while back. He was had it in his garage. He couldn't park any of his vehicles in it because he had it in totes in a garage. You know, that's for these farmers, they're willing to do that because they're innovative and they're willing to try some new ideas. But that can only, you know, they're taking on a lot of the risk. And so that's, you can only take that so far.
Well, to give you one sense, I know some of the work that's going on in the oat efforts around scaling or bringing back oats in some kind of significant way in southern Minnesota, and to give you a scale of the kind of capital that's needed to put real infrastructure in play, you know, an oat facility that would support maybe 50,000 acres of production costs $50 million. So how do you put that capital stack together?
Right.
A lot of it comes through USDA loans and grants.
Yeah.
But can there be some farmer buy-in option? But that's a lot of capital to put together. It's great when farmers invest in solutions. It shows that there's an appetite and a readiness. But then, so I just kind of sharing with your listeners the real challenges to putting infrastructure in play that would make, you know, something out of the corn-soybean rotation as easy as driving it to the elevator. And even then, you know, you got to line up the market for that, and you have to, you know, manage that facility and so on. So I'm just kind of giving one data point example of what it means to build value chains and markets for these crops.
Most of the farmers, maybe almost all the farmers, at least that I know of, who have been experimenting with Kernza are smaller. And they're the ones that are most vulnerable to taking risks like this. And so what are some of the, some of the things that can help alleviate some of that risk for some of these farmers?
Sure. I'll talk about more on the farmer side. And then there's also some support in place to develop value chains and markets.
Okay.
Which farmers are directly benefiting from and indirectly by building those markets. But I'll just share on the grower side. One of the first things when Kernza became ready to move out to the world, funding that comes from MDA to Forever Green Crops, MDA and Forever Green said, we got to break off a part of this money.
That's the
Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Yeah.
Wisely said, you know, we should break off some of this money and think about implementation, meaning farmer adoption. How are we going to support that? That was about 5 years ago, and that led to the development of the ECO program, spelled E-E-C-O. It stands for Economic and Environmental Clusters of Opportunity.
Oh, that's a great acronym.
You need an acronym, right? And the quick sketch is that this funding through the Minnesota Department of Agriculture comes to the University of Minnesota, and the ECO program is structured by offering two types of financial assistance coupled with technical assistance.
Mm-hmm.
And that financial assistance comes in the form of an ecosystem service payment, an environmental benefit payment. $25 to $50 per acre per year based on the nutrient tracking tool. We actually map, you know, where that Kernza is going in the ground and what the potential nitrate leaching reduction would be and get a per acre payment. We also built in risk management. This is a really important part. In talking to farmers, we said, hey, what kind of support do you need to adopt this? And they're like, well, those $10 an acre cover crop payments are nice, but they don't really foot the bill, right? What if this doesn't work out? Who pays? And I was like, well, let's see what we can do. So we essentially designed a kind of pilot partial crop insurance, not in partnership with RMA. I'm hesitant to call it crop insurance, but it's risk management. So in the event of market or agronomic failure, we will share up to 50% of the cost of production, which for Kernza works out to about $175 an acre, right? So there's a practice standard. If you plant in November and it doesn't establish, well, we're not getting payment. But if you plant when you're supposed to, you know, roughly speaking, kind of follow the agronomic guidelines, and it doesn't work out for you, we will eat half the bill. The state of Minnesota will eat half the bill. That is quite a unique program for farmers. We also have a full-time agronomist, Matt Levitt, who works with Kernza farmers, provides that in-field and remote technical support. And that program also provides seed and grain testing to help farmers get their cost to, their grain to market. There's additional state and federal programs now in place for Kernza. Our state NRCS office has been very supportive through conservation crop rotation. And at the federal level in the CSP, there's a CSP enhancement, 328O, that also pays, I think, about $150 per acre for a three-year enrollment.
Yeah, but where are we at with the developing market side to help deal with some of these risks that the farmers are taking?
Minnesota Department of Agriculture also has a program called the Developing Markets for Continuous Living Cover Crops Grant. That is a very long acronym.
Yeah, I don't want to hear that acronym.
I don't think it even has an abbreviation. It's just Developing Markets for CLC Crops.
Okay.
But it's a great program that provides up to $45,000 in grant money per applicant. If selected, and it is to develop exactly what it sounds like, the market and the infrastructure to get continuous living cover crops, which includes Kernza and all of the forevergreen crops that we're working on, to get those out into the market. And so it has a couple of rounds that have been awarded and at least one more that is still open. And so if anyone wants to apply for that to improve the processing infrastructure or has a marketing idea, it's a great opportunity. And we've definitely seen some grower cooperatives use it. And we've also seen people who are not growers but are building things that indirectly benefit growers, as Colin mentioned at the outset.
Just to round out this conversation to give you a scale of how much has been invested in those programs, that ECO program has deployed about $250,000 in support directly to early adopter Kernza farmers. For the environmental benefit of water quality they've generated for the public, and on the risk management side, about $250,000 thus far in technical assistance through staff capacity to be in the field when needed or be on the other end of a phone when needed. And the Developing Markets for CLC Crops program has deployed, I think, probably about $200,000 to Kernza businesses, including a farmer-owned and led cooperative, and helped bring a new processing facility online for one of our supply chain partners to get their new products to market. So add that up, and the state of Minnesota is sharing risk with farmers, providing that technical assistance, and supporting the market development. And I think it's great that we're taking a little time to detail that, because we might hear of, oh, when there's a challenge, but we don't often talk enough about how the state of Minnesota has taken a really strong leadership role in putting some safety net and risk sharing in place until we can get to the kind of federal solutions. And that's been a really unique aspect of why I think Minnesota has been a leader in this work.
And we touched on this a little bit throughout the interview, but what are some lessons we've learned? We kind of set this interview out by saying that Kernza is a little bit of a case study and can help maybe be a learning, something that we learn some lessons from to guide these other, this portfolio of other, these 15 crops that Forever Green is working on. But what are some lessons learned that maybe could be applied? Because who knows? I hope Kernza works out. Maybe it won't. But if there's some lessons to be learned that can be applied to other, because we sure know that we need something in that rotation other than corn and beans. And we need something to make that system more efficient ecologically and economically. So what are some lessons that we're kind of gathering from? Because that's part of this, too. It's not just our end result is we got to get this third crop or whatever we're going to call it. It's also what have we learned from this that can be applied to other systems, to other crops out there that we're maybe going to promote in the future or that we're promoting right now and working on right now.
the one that comes to mind to me is to continue thinking about how to innovate across the value chain all at the same time. So having support for people who want to use a new ingredient and teaching them how to do it and making it as easy as possible, providing structures that enable demand at the same time as you're building supply, and really thinking through all of those systems and what's needed to build them in parallel is something that I think we can translate to other crops that will be launched in the future too.
Cool. What do you think, Colin?
Oh, I could probably opine on this question for for an hour, but I'll save your ears. But a few. One is I have thought more recently about better equipping and resourcing and de-risking those early stage entrepreneurs that galvanize around a new opportunity. I think we often look to the market at large to solve our biggest problems, but if you look at other segments of how innovation happens, we didn't run with that early stage solar panel, or if we did, to like ExxonMobil. Right. And say, aren't you excited? It's energy, right? Or the first electric car, right, or the first digital camera to Kodak, or what happens. Like, change happens over time, but there's an innovation process. And that early stage is often led by the more risk-tolerant entrepreneurs that take a new solution to market, work out the bugs, prove that it's possible, scale it up a little bit. And those entrepreneurs can be farmers operating a co-op, or they could be value chain entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And I've thought more about how we could orient better to those actors and support them. I think they play a critical role in innovation, but they have a high failure rate, or they struggle a lot. They might not have the capital that they need, or the expertise or the co-founding team support to really drive that. They might have a lot of passion, but maybe not necessarily the right toolkit. And so I'm kind of thinking a lot about and incubating strategies in that space we could talk about another time. Another is going back to Forever Green's core theory of change. If Kernza yielded five times as much, those challenges would be a lot less, right? It would support farmers' livelihoods to the same degree, but be a lower, you know, cost product to move into the market. Right now, it's a very premium niche thing. And so this core role of the R&D effort pushing all this forward, we don't think about that a lot as a society, developing new crops or improving crops. Mm-hmm. We could say, well, you know, industry's not buying, or this price is too high, you know, to the grower. And that's just we're just fighting over the limited pie we got. Right. When what we need to do as a society, invest in new solutions for farmers and for industry that bring like a different value proposition to society. And that's what Forever Green's all about.
For more on Forever Green and diversifying agriculture with different cropping systems, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 367 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendale, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.